The new logo was the iconic image of U.S. Marines raising a flag over Iwo Jima. And the new motto below the logo was, "So exclusive you fought to get in." By the time Carter left in 1995, 4 years later, North Chicago was receiving awards for healthcare excellence. How exactly they did what they did is relevant here, mainly because of where it led Carter Mesher. It led him to take an interest in medical error, and that interest soon became an obsession. It led also to a new job. After the VA, having seen this miraculous turnaround in North Chicago, asked him to move to Atlanta and serve as chief medical officer for an entire region. "Each time I moved, I felt like I was walking upstairs and the view was getting bigger," said Carter. "Atlanta was like the next veranda. It was the first time in my life that I got to see things at a national level. That was when I started to see the world differently, to see systems." In Atlanta, he oversaw 9 big hospitals across 3 states, with no end to the mistakes that might be made inside of them. Often it was the thing you most took for granted that proved most deadly. The hot water, for instance. Taking steam as their heat source, VA hospitals heated water to very specific temperatures, hot enough to kill certain bacteria, but cool enough that it didn't scald. To make sure the water didn't emerge too hot, they'd installed special valves on the bathtub faucets. The mechanism that heated the water had broken, however, and the water was coming out too cool. To compensate, the nurses set a valve on the tub to a hotter setting. That valve had incited a kind of failsafe. It shut off the hot water above a certain temperature, all of which seemed fine until, one night, plumbing engineers came and fixed the heating mechanism without telling the nurses. Normally, the special valve on the tub would have prevented the water from filling the tub, but, unbeknownst to all, as the tub had not been used while the pipes were busted, the special valve was also busted. Normally, you could rely on the patient to let you know the water was too hot. But there was one patient in the VA hospital, an old guy with mental health problems. No matter what the nurses did for him, he screamed. The nurses would always bathe him first to relieve the pressure on the next shift. And so it happened that, after the engineers fixed the pipes, the man who screamed when treated was the first patient to be given a bath. "The nurses don't know the valve doesn't work," said Carter. "They don't know the engineers have set the temperature too high, and the first person they bathe screams no matter what you do. When they put him in, he screamed. An hour later, the man's skin was peeling away and he was dying of thermal burns. And Carter was fielding calls from various people to let him know that the system he oversaw had boiled someone alive. The nurses were devastated, but to Carter's way of thinking, they were victims too. The environment in which they worked, in which they had been encouraged to trust, had failed them. When you go into the details of the cases, you see it's not bad people," he said. "It's bad systems. When the systems depend on human vigilance, they will fail." In medical error, he'd found a subject that focused his attention as sharply as a code blue in the intensive care unit. To keep patients safe, he felt he needed to know all the details of anything that had gone wrong in a way that was odd for a person in his position. Not long after he became its supervisor, the VA hospital in Charleston, South Carolina, identified an issue. The patients in their care were dying in higher numbers than elsewhere from colon cancer. A shocking percentage of the cancers were being found only once they had reached the stage at which they were untreatable. No one could figure out why. Carter visited the hospital to poke around. He now had a rule. If you visit a hospital to investigate some problem, visit more than once. As on the first visit, the locals assume that you have come merely to find fault and assign blame, rather to enlist them as partners in the hunt for the flaw in the system. He'd learned that from some field anthropologists whom he had sought out. They taught me how important it was to have a second visit when they visited villages, said Carter. The second visit made a statement to the villagers, and it usually wasn't until the second visit that trust emerged. Not until his second visit to Charleston did Carter start asking how they treated certain high-risk patients, how they scheduled colonoscopies, and so on. He made a point of asking questions in plain English, and less in the manner of a doctor than a child. Why do you do it this way? Can you show me how you do that? Putting things simply made it easier to ask important questions that, if put in doctor speak, might sound silly. By his third visit, the nurses were walking him through every stage of the colon cancer detection process. I never told them what I would do, said Carter. I was allowing them to open the curtain and take a look. You see so much. If people would just spend their time and observe, you don't need any advanced degrees. Touring him around, the nurses realized something they'd missed. The hospital's patients were surprisingly unlikely to mail back their colon cancer test kits. The Charleston Hospital, like other hospitals, mailed out these test kits with little cards on which patients were meant to capture a stool sample. To ensure that the test kits made their way back to the hospital enclosed pre-addressed envelopes. Carter had asked if they could go see where the test kit envelopes arrived. They took him to the mail room, where someone dumped the sack with the day's mail onto a table. A bunch of test kits were in the pile, but each envelope bore the same red notice. Insufficient postage returned to sender. Thank God the post office delivered them anyway. One of the nurses said, I wonder how many of them were returned to the sender. Bulbs went off in everyone's head, said Carter. It had occurred to no one that the colon cancer test kits might require two postage stamps. Who the hell would know that you need more than one stamp to send it back to the medical center? I would have done the same thing. People were dying for a stamp. The Charleston VA began to send out pre-addressed envelopes with two stamps, and within a year had leapt to the front of the pack in its detection of colon cancer. I loved that moment, said Carter. It was so common sense. One way to reduce medical error, he thought, was to redesign the environment to make it more difficult for bad things to happen. You cannot put a 120-volt plug into a 240-volt outlet, he said, by way of analogy. Why? You can't do it. You can't fit it in. In medicine, there were too many 120-volt plugs that fit into 240-volt outlets. The ease with which a nurse might give one patient medicine intended for another, for example. When he heard that a nurse at a VA hospital in Topeka, Kansas had the bright idea of using barcodes on patients and medications to match them up, Carter grabbed it and spread it across his entire system. He also set out to learn everything he could about the inner workings of the human mind and where and why it was prone to err. He found a book called Human Error by a British psychologist aptly named James Reason. It was like reading the owner's manual of the human mind, he later recalled. Not the usual owner's manual, but an owner's manual that pointed out all the peculiarities and idiosyncrasies of how we operate, especially under conditions of stress. The ICU was a stressful and complicated place. Carter had experienced what Reason described. He was struck especially by Reason's argument that the best way to guard against error is to design systems with layered and overlapping defenses. There was an image of Reason's that Carter loved, of slices of Swiss cheese being layered on top of one another, until there were no holes you could see through. All of which was to say, that when he was handed his new job in Atlanta, his mind behaved a bit the way it did when he was a kid, sitting in the classroom, and the teacher said something that caused him to think of something else. He was always less interested in answering the question he'd been asked than in finding a more interesting question to answer. So, while running a bunch of hospitals, he was also now making himself expert in all sorts of seemingly irrelevant subjects. Aviation safety, for instance. Whenever two planes almost collided, the Federal Aviation Administration knew about it and investigated. But when a nurse screwed up and gave a patient medications intended for another, no one made a note of it unless the patient died. That stuff resonated with me like crazy, said Carter. You can keep mistakes from happening if you can identify the almost mistakes. This kind of changes how I view everything. He felt strongly that Veterans Affairs should attack the mistakes that happened inside its hospitals in a more systematic way, by scouring the system for almost mistakes, near misses. It was the natural place to explore medical error, because unlike a similar situation in the private sector, you can't hide it, he said. He implored his bosses in Washington, D.C. to create a safe space in which people felt comfortable admitting the bad things that had almost happened. He wrote long memos to the other 21 chief medical officers in the VA system, pushing them to press for change. We need an incident reporting system in medicine, he wrote in one. We focus on the bad event, we ignore what didn't happen, we crucify whoever was in the bad event and ignore the others. And that's not how you fix the system. It wasn't easy to create a safe space with members of Congress gazing over your shoulder, looking for mistakes to publicize for political gain. Carter sensed that his memos weren't having the desired effect in Washington. I felt like we were not having a serious conversation, he said. Instead of an incident reporting system, in 2001, the head office created a lessons learned website, which allowed anyone in the VA system to log in and post. Most of what was posted, however, was not confessions of medical error or stories of near misses, but ideas and insights that reflected glory upon the author. The VA website quickly became a suggestion box stuffed with thinly veiled personal advertisements. The hope was that employees would go onto the website and adopt these great ideas, said Carter. But nobody did. Leaders were not happy. By then, the leaders had a sense that their chief medical officer in Atlanta was a bit different from the others and had a taste for tackling unusual problems. They asked Carter to create a committee to find the 5 best new ideas on the VA website and spread them throughout the system. Once again, the teacher had unintentionally said something that interested Carter Mesher and caused his mind to wander. Specifically, he wondered, if these ideas on the Lessons Learned website are so good, why haven't any of them taken off? And why were all these other ideas spreading inside the VA without anyone's help? For some reason, this caused him to ponder the wheelie bag. One day, everyone is humping their luggage around the airport. The next, everyone's got a wheelie bag. The wheelie bag was what a good idea looked like. It just sort of took off on its own. Then he asked himself, why did some ideas attract attention while others did not? Why did he have this stack of unread back issues of the New England Journal of Medicine piled up in his office and making him feel guilty? What caused him actually to open the New England Journal of Medicine? For that matter, why did so much of what he learned in life come from doing some job and so little from school? And why? Well, from there his mind became totally engrossed, but not with the problem his superiors had asked him to solve. I did pull a group together, said Carter, but the task I gave the group was to figure out why the idea of a lessons learned website didn't work. He spent the next year making himself expert on why and in what circumstances people learned, and why and in what circumstances they did not. He read many books, hunted down many authors in person, and picked their brains to see what else might be inside of them. He wrote a long report for the people at the top of the Department of Veterans Affairs about, in effect, why its lessons learned website was dumb. The gist of it was that people don't learn what is imposed upon them, but rather what they freely seek out of desire or need. For people to learn, they need to want to learn. "How many times have you traveled by air?" Carter began in his report to his superiors. "Dozens, perhaps even hundreds of times. A common aircraft you might have flown on is a Boeing 757. Boeing has produced nearly 2,000 of these aircraft, and Delta Airlines alone has over 100 of these aircraft in its fleet. It is rather likely, given the frequency with which you travel, that you have flown on this type of aircraft. During the pre-flight safety instructions, you were treated to a multimedia event." He described all the ways that airlines try to hammer safety information into the minds of the passengers, then asked, "How many times have you been exposed to this sort of training?" "Dozens? Hundreds of times?" "Try answering the following questions. How many exits are on a 757? 4? 6? 8? What does orange and red lighting identify? How do you remove the life vests under your seats?" And so on. There were 30 pages more like this, and an argument for creating, inside the VA, a new kind of institution that he called a learning exchange. "People in an organization learn," said Carter. "They're learning all kinds of things, but they aren't learning what you are teaching them. You go to a formal meeting. The important conversation is not in the meeting. It's in the halls during the breaks. And usually what's important is taboo. And you can't say it in the formal meeting." He was trying, among other things, to create ways to admit the conversation from the hallways into the formal meeting. But of course, the people running the meeting had their reasons for keeping it out. "We handed in the report," said Carter. "They didn't know what to do with it. They asked us if we could please just pick the 4 or 5 best ideas on the Lessons Learned website and spread them throughout the system." In late October 2005, the VA received a request from the White House. The request was submitted to a VA doctor named Lawrence Deaton, who had played a leading role in the treatment of HIV. He was just then creating a program which would prove successful to wean veterans off cigarettes. The White House was looking for an unusual person and a chief medical officer type to help think through a big national health problem. Dr. Deaton walked the request down the hall to the office of Odette Levesque, who knew maybe better than anyone the 22 chief medical officers in the VA medical system. Levesque was a nurse by training and the human link between the VA head doctors in the field and headquarters. "If I needed help on a certain issue, I knew who to call," she said. She looked at the White House request. "They wanted someone who could think outside the box," she said. "There was only one name that came to mind, and that was Carter Mesher." Carter was surprised by the call from the White House, and even more surprised by what they wanted him to do. He'd learned a lot about infectious disease by treating it in various intensive care units. He knew nothing about pandemics and hadn't given any thought to how to plan for them. "But it was the White House calling," he said. "I figured, yeah, yeah, what the hell." In late November 2005, he went to Washington and, with the 6 other members of the new team, was installed in a room at the end of a corridor on the 4th floor of the old executive office building. next door to the White House. It had 10 workstations, just computers with desks and chairs and no partitions. But it did have a lovely view of the Rose Garden and the Marine One landing pad. In the room adjacent to them, people were cleaning up the mess left by Hurricane Katrina. From the moment he convened with his new team of pandemic planners, Carter sensed that one of these things was not like the others, and that that thing might be him. To their first meeting, the other 6 members of the team wore suits. Carter had thought he was dressing up by putting on a sports coat, and right afterward, he went to Joseph A. Bank and bought 5 suits, which he wore in rotation. Even then, he didn't get it quite right. Your first impression of Carter is, yes, he's now bought a suit, but he's wearing combat boots with it, said Ken Staley, who worked for Rajiv and Kaya and supervised the pandemic planners. You ask him why, and he says someone gave them to him, and he thought they were cool. Richard Hatchett watched Carter with interest, too. We were all sort of thrown into a room with people from across government who we didn't know, said Richard. It took a while for Carter to unfold, to feel comfortable with us, and to be willing to go where his head goes. Carter's head, at first, had no idea where to go. We all had the same title, said Carter. It was like a bullshit title, but I'm kind of the doofus from the VA. Everyone else is from D.C., and they're all policy people, and I never did this crap before. As they divvied up responsibilities, Carter had trouble following what they were talking about. It's like starting a new school, and everyone else is ahead of me, said Carter. It's all new. It's all different. They're using acronyms. The words they are using aren't words that I normally use. APHIS, FBO, CBO, HSPD, PCC, interagency. That last one wasn't an acronym, but Carter didn't really know what it meant. The entire federal government felt to him like some gigantic black box. One of the people on the team was from the Department of Agriculture, and everyone else seemed to know exactly what that department did. Carter had no real clue. The others kept referring to the NRP until finally Carter leaned over and asked Richard, "What the hell's NRP?" "The National Response Plan," said Richard. "It lays out how the federal government organizes itself during an emergency." That sounded important to Carter, and so he went and found a copy and read all 400 pages of it and felt no wiser for the experience. "It's all government language," he said. "They're just saying the same thing over and over." The other 6 members of the team each had some obvious narrow role to play. The woman from the Department of Homeland Security would write the chapter on transportation and borders. The guy from the Agriculture Department would write the chapter on protecting the health of farm animals. The other doctor in the room, Richard Hatchett, had somehow already been given the job of writing the key chapter in the plan, Chapter 6, which would be the strategy for minimizing illness and death in humans. The divvying up of the plan was a bit like musical chairs, and when the music stopped, everyone but Carter had a seat. As he recalled, Rajiv just said, "Richard, you're going to work on Chapter 6, and Carter, you'll help Richard." Once Carter saw how government reports got written, he understood why no one ever really wanted to read them. Richard was a natural writer, but there was no place in the process for a natural writer. "There were all these stupid rules," said Carter, whose first job was making sure that whatever Richard wrote conformed to the U.S. government's style manual. "Like you need to put countries and states in alphabetical order so no one is offended. You can't say over $300. You have to say more than." The bigger obstacle to Clear Prose was the sheer number of people invited to complain about whatever Richard wrote. Anything that implicated any federal agency had to be sent to that agency for approval. So we'd send it to, like, the EPA, said Carter. And it wasn't one person at the EPA. It was 10. There were times I had 5 different comments on the same sentence, all wanting me to change the sentence a different way. The process drove Richard Hatchett nuts. It just gets dumber and dumber, he'd say. Richard and Carter thought in slightly different ways about the problem of stopping a deadly disease as it swept through the population. Richard's mental model was warfare, with an enemy that resembled a network of highly connected nodes. Identify the nodes with the most connections and take them out. That's how you won the war against a virus. Carter's first analogy was with a medical error. He'd designed systems to minimize the likelihood of mistakes being made by doctors and nurses. He was now designing a strategy to minimize the likelihood of a bug jumping from one person to another. What their views had in common, he suspected, was the absence of a magic bullet. The solution would be a layering of multiple strategies, sort of the way you laid slices of Swiss cheese on a sandwich, so that the holes did not align. He began to write memos to the group about the Swiss cheese strategy. Inside their room in the old executive office building, both Carter and Richard saw that there was more than one thing going on. There was this official plan that they were dutifully hammering out, from which all joy and flair had been squeezed by a mad editorial process. Then there was what the plan might allow them to do. In other words, the plan wasn't really the plan, but a plan to have a plan. And the original 12-page document that Rajiv had created now looked more and more like a plan to have a plan to have a plan. The actual words that ended up in the chapter they wrote would remain vague enough to justify doing any number of things. There was, most importantly, a passage that suggested what the federal government might do at the start of a pandemic before a vaccine was available. It would, they'd written, provide guidance, including decision criteria and tools, to all levels of government on the range of options for infection control and containment, including those circumstances where social distancing measures, limitations on gatherings, or quarantine authority may be an appropriate public health intervention. It was hard to imagine anyone wading into that passage voluntarily, much less giving it a second thought. The words mattered less for what they said than for what they could be made to say. Like the words in the Holy Bible or the U.S. Constitution, they invited the problem of how they might be interpreted, and by whom, and for what purposes. As read by Richard Hatchett and Carter Mesher, those words gave them cover to answer the most important medical question they'd ever faced. How do you save lives in a pandemic before you have the drugs and vaccines to do it? 4. Stopping the Unstoppable. One day some historian will look back and say how remarkable it was that these strange folk who called themselves Americans ever governed themselves at all, given how they went about it. Inside the United States government were all these little boxes. The boxes had been created to address specific problems as they arose. How to ensure our food is safe to eat, for instance, or how to avoid a run on the banks, or how to prevent another terrorist attack. Each box was given to people with knowledge and talent and expertise useful to its assigned problem, and, over time, those people created a culture around the problem, distinct from the cultures in the other little boxes. Each box became its own small frozen world with little ability to adapt and little interest in whatever might be going on inside the other boxes. People who complained about government waste, usually fixated on the ways taxpayer money got spent. But here was the real waste. One box might contain the solution to a problem in another box, or the person who might find that solution, and that second box would never know about it. Sandia National Laboratories had been created back in the mid-1940s in part to help the people stuck in various boxes to think outside them. Even by the high standards of the Sandians, Bob Glass was a gifted thinker whose mind naturally belonged in no one box. Yet by the spring of 2006, he felt trapped. In the 2 years since its conception, his 15-year-old daughter's science fair project had spun up into this grown-up model of disease control. He'd found data from the long-forgotten flu pandemic of 1957 to 58, estimated to have killed more than 100,000 Americans, and used it to test his model. Given the broad facts about the disease, the model had basically reproduced that pandemic. The illness and death that had occurred in each age group in real life recurred in the model, for instance. Bob Glass had now read enough about epidemiology to know that his daughter's project was an original contribution to the field. I asked myself, why didn't these epidemiologists figure it out? They didn't figure it out because they didn't have tools that were focused on the problem. They had tools to understand the movement of infectious disease without the purpose of trying to stop it. With the help of the computer programming genius at Sandia Labs, he and Laura had built a tool that might stop a disease. He was stunned by how difficult it had been to get anyone to use it or even notice it. Some months earlier, the White House's Homeland Security Council had asked Sandia Labs to help it prepare for a tabletop exercise on pandemic flu. What questions should they address? What should they think about that they might not have considered? The same Oval Office meeting that led to the creation of a pandemic plan also spawned this brief exercise. The exercise occurred on December 10, 2005, just as the planning got underway. It had no effect on the planning. But the group inside Sandia assigned the task wasn't Bob Glass's group. Glass talked a friend into slipping a note about his model into the packet they sent to the White House, but the Homeland Security people had ignored it. "There's a natural inclination towards certain narratives," said Glass. "Instead of worrying how to stop this thing, they got wrapped up in a thing from outside the country that was coming in, and so they spent all their time talking about closing borders, which is exactly what does not work. It also immediately shuts down all economic flows." The only way to get attention for this new tool for disease control, Glass decided, was to write it up in a paper for an academic journal. The scientists at Sandia National Labs worked under the highest security clearance in the federal government called Q clearance, and were prohibited from revealing their work without first seeking approval. The work was his kids' science fair project, but he was now taking it as seriously as anything he did at Sandia. So he explained the situation to his superiors and wrote up a long paper, which at length they allowed him to publish. He sent it to Science and Nature and to other more obscure journals of medical science. "Every one of them just returned it to me unread because I wasn't known in their field," he said. "So then I got really worried." When asked about himself, which he seldom was, as he spent so much of his time alone in thought, Bob Glass described himself as an extreme introvert. It violated his nature to reach out personally to people in the field of communicable disease and seek their help. But he did it anyway. He found the names of professional epidemiologists who claimed to be using computer models to study disease spread and sent them his paper, along with a note. "They wouldn't even return my emails," he said. "They just didn't respond. So then I got pissed. I had this fear. A pandemic will occur and no one would do anything right. I thought I was dead. I thought we were all dead. Then I remembered the guy at the VA. A year and a half earlier, Laura had gone to Washington, D.C. to visit her aunt. Over dinner one night, she told her aunt's boyfriend, an infectious disease specialist who worked for the Department of Veterans Affairs, about her science fair project. "You should write that up and publish it," he said with enthusiasm. He said he'd never heard of anything like it. When she returned home, she told her father about the dinner.
"I thought, geez, this is going to take a lot of work," he'd said.
But he agreed to turn the science fair project into a serious academic paper on disease control, authored jointly. The VA guy had already had one big effect on their work, Bob Glass thought. Maybe he could have another. It troubled him deeply to use his sister's boyfriend to get attention for a scientific discovery, but he didn't know anyone else in the federal government in Washington, D.C.
"You just don't do this in science," Glass said. But I said, "I'm going to do something someone my age never does. I'm going to go around the system."
I write him an email and attach the paper and ask, "Do you know anyone who needs to see this?" At that point, he'd spent the better part of 6 months trying to get the attention of experts in disease control. Inside of 6 hours, he had a call from Richard Hatchett.
He said, "We're in the White House," recalled Bob Glass. "When can you come and talk to us?"
As it turned out, the guy at the Department of Veterans Affairs, who had once dated Bob Glass's sister, actually knew Carter Mesher and had emailed him everything Bob had sent.
"When I first saw it, I was like, what the hell is this?" said Carter.
"Most things you get in the White House are kind of bullshit stuff." His mind still hadn't shaken free of his project at the VA, which revealed to him how poor official channels could be for the transfer of information and how rich the unofficial ones could be. Richard had become obsessed with the idea of using models to shape their pandemic strategy, and so Carter had forwarded him the whole package. The VA guy's email, together with all the stuff Bob Glass had attached. Richard was nearly alone in his interest in models. The National Institutes of Health had funded 3 academics to build models of disease, but it was unclear how useful they would be. The new models were complicated and slow and expensive to run. If you asked a simple question, for instance, what happens to the spread of a certain disease if you insist that people work from home? It could take days to get an answer. Even then, you felt faintly suspicious because the model's complexity made it nearly impossible to see what was going on inside them. Richard invited the academics for a meeting so that he could pick their brains. He liked them more than Carter did. Carter thought they were pretentious. After the meeting, Richard compiled a spreadsheet with hundreds of columns in an attempt to describe the features of each model. Each made assumptions about the nature of the new disease attacking the population. How it spread. How likely an infected person was to infect another person. How likely it was to kill, and so on. There were even more assumptions about the population under attack. Age distribution, living arrangements, employment, vaccination rates, and so on. Compiling the spreadsheet was tedious, but Richard sensed that the models offered the only hope of finding some new strategy. Working alone on his spreadsheet, he had one of the most curious experiences of his life. As a small child, he'd suffered a horrific accident. He'd never quite shaken its after effects. It had happened when he was on vacation with his parents. They were visiting Bushkill Falls in Pennsylvania and walking along a path carved into a steep cliff. Richard dropped a pack of lifesavers he'd been clutching, then chased them under a fence and off the cliff. He plummeted 70 feet into a creek.
By the time his father reached him, he was face down in the water, not breathing. He was bleeding from a deep gash in his forehead, and his jaw was locked. His father, a banker with no medical training, by sheer chance had just learned a bit about pediatric life support from a friend who was taking a course on the subject. Unable to pry open his son's jaws, he knew to breathe into his nostrils. He did this until Richard once again began to breathe. Growing up in Alabama, Richard heard that story over and over. It always ended with my parents saying that I had been saved for a reason, he said. And I think my father, and maybe my mother as well, actually came to believe it. So that was a kind of heavy thing to grow up with. He'd achieved enough along the way to feel that maybe he had some special destiny, but he never really thought what it might be or spoke of it. Grandiosity mortified him. He really was, at his core, a Southern gentleman poet. And so it was strange indeed that, as he sat there in the White House compiling this extremely boring spreadsheet about these possibly useless models, he was overcome by feeling. It hit me like a lightning bolt, he said. This is it. Solving this problem is why I'm here. I'm the only person in the White House who cares about this stuff, and if I don't pursue this, it won't happen. And I mean, it really hit me like a thunderclap. Like, the only time ever in my life that I had something like that happen. Later, he made sense of that feeling. In the moment, he was aware mainly of just how nearly alone he was in the view that there might actually be ways to stop a new disease once it began to sweep through the population. A powerful conventional wisdom held that there was only one effective strategy. Isolate the ill and hustle to create and distribute vaccines and antiviral drugs. That other ideas, including social interventions to keep people physically farther apart from each other, had been tried back in 1918 and hadn't worked. America's leading disease experts, the people inside the CDC, and elsewhere in the Department of Health and Human Services, agreed on this point. Richard was by then friends with the most famous of them all, D.A. Henderson. Donald Ainslie Henderson was maybe 6'2", but in Richard's mind, he stood 12'6" and loomed even larger in his field. Among other achievements, he was known as the man who, in his work with the World Health Organization, had eradicated smallpox. Never before has man set out to eradicate a disease and succeeded, D.A. told one interviewer. Obviously, no one has ever single-handedly eradicated a disease. The former head of the CDC, Tom Frieden, introduced another former head of the CDC, William Fagy, to me as the man who eradicated smallpox. At any rate, the last known case of smallpox was a 23-year-old Somalian who was diagnosed on October 26, 1977. He'd been dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and held other titles, but he was, when Richard arrived there, on assignment at the Department of Health and Human Services. Back then, Richard had listened to D.A. vent about the newest idiots at fancy universities who thought they could capture anything meaningful about disease control in a computer model. He thought they had no idea what they were talking about, said Richard. They'd not spoken about the subject, but Richard could guess what D.A. would make of what he was now up to. D.A. had been in charge of the federal government's response back in 1957-58, when that new strain of flu had killed more than 100,000 Americans. He'd advised doing no more than isolating the ill and waiting for a vaccine, as the costs of any other strategy exceeded any possible benefits. Richard couldn't understand his certainty, or the weird conventional wisdom that had coalesced. One thing that's inarguably true is that if you got everyone and locked each of them in their own room and didn't let them talk to anyone, you would not have any disease, he said. The question was, can you do anything in the real world? The new models of disease, slow and unwieldy though they were, gave Richard hope. D.A. Henderson and the people at the CDC, along with pretty much everyone else in the public health sector, thought that the models had nothing to offer. But they were missing the point. They, too, used models. They, too, depended on abstractions to inform their judgments. Those abstractions just happened to be inside their heads. Experts took the models in their minds as the essence of reality. But the biggest difference between their models and the ones inside the computer was that their models were less explicit and harder to check. Experts made all sorts of assumptions about the world, just as computer models did. But those assumptions were invisible. And there was every day fresh evidence that the models inside the minds of experts could be seriously flawed. In professional sports, for example, for decades, former players went unquestioned as experts in the evaluation of both players and strategies. Then came the statistical revolution. Complete outsiders, armed with mathematical models, had made a mockery of the experts. The market forces that punish ignorance were far more intense in pro sports than they were in disease control. The mistakes made by epidemiologists didn't cause their teams to lose and their bosses to waste tens of millions of dollars. If models could improve predictions about some basketball player's value in a game, there was no reason they couldn't do the same for the value of some new strategy in a pandemic. Richard believed that if the country was suddenly overwhelmed by some strain of flu for which there was no vaccine, there nonetheless existed strategies to prevent illness and death. He also wanted to believe that the benefits of these strategies could exceed their costs. He even thought it might be possible to eradicate a new virus without a vaccine. The trick there would be to lower the disease's reproductive rate, the number of people each infected person in turn infected. Drive that number below one, and a disease would flicker and die. But as few disease control experts believed any of these things, and so would not explore possible strategies in a real-life pandemic, he needed the models to explore the strategies in an artificial world. And so when he opened the email from Carter and looked at what Bob Glass had done, it took him no time at all to realize that the White House needed Bob Glass. Once Carter saw Richard's enthusiasm, he too opened what Bob Glass had sent and started playing around with it. The math, he understood. The thinking was clear and simple. All the rules the guy and his daughter had used to describe the social lives of kids and grown-ups felt plausible. Ditto the rules governing the spread of the disease. The only problem was that the model's output was just a bunch of numbers listed in these mind-numbingly long tables. Most people can't read tables, said Carter. They need to see it graphically. Carter turned the numbers into a graph. The picture shocked him. The graph illustrated the effects on a disease of various crude strategies. Isolating the ill, quarantining entire households when they had a sick person in them, socially distancing adults, giving people antiviral drugs, and so on. Each of the crude strategies had some slight effect, but none by itself made much of a dent, and certainly none had the ability to halt the pandemic by driving the disease's reproductive rate below one. One intervention was not like the others, however. When you closed schools and put social distance between kids, the flu-like disease fell off a cliff. The model defined social distance not as zero contact, but as a 60% reduction in kids' social interaction. I said, "Holy shit," said Carter. Nothing big happens until you close the schools. It's not like anything else. It's like a phase change. It's non-linear. It's like when water temperature goes from 33 to 32. When it goes from 34 to 33, it's no big deal. 1 degree colder, and it turns to ice. He and Richard didn't let themselves get too excited at first. We said, okay, this is just a toy model, so now we need to go and talk to the really sophisticated modelers, recalled Carter. They had the three academics with their big, complicated models more or less on call. When you fed into those models the question, what happens if you do nothing but close schools and reduce the social interaction of minors by 60%? They responded slowly, but as one. That works. It was now April of 2006. With the exception of a tedious final chapter about the practical business of keeping big institutions open during a pandemic, the official strategy of the United States was as good as finished, and less than a month from publication. It detailed all the actions, big and small, for federal agencies to take. Most of the line items didn't much interest either Carter or Richard. For example, educating bird owners. We will expand our multi-level outreach and education campaign called Biosecurity for the Birds to provide disease and biosecurity information to poultry producers, especially those with backyard operations. Page 11. There were hundreds of these kinds of things, and someone in the federal government would do them. The Department of Agriculture in this case. But it wasn't until after the plan had been written that Carter and Richard felt real excitement. But now it was apparent that the two doctors on the pandemic planning team were leaving everyone else behind. They were no longer working normal hours, even by White House standards. You'd see Richard on the phone late at night, explaining to his wife when he might be coming home, recalls one White House colleague. He was like cheating on his family for pandemic preparedness. The intensity of their partnership caught their new colleagues by surprise. The odd couple, Ken Staley, who worked in Rajiv's bioterrorism unit, called them. Richard played chess and quoted Borges. Carter took apart pickup trucks and put them back together. Much of what Richard loved doing could be done in a white linen suit. Much of what Carter loved doing left his hands black. Richard liked to borrow a phrase, Carter a tool. Richard was top down. He conversed easily with the fancy academics and important policy people, and they with him. Carter was bottom up. There was no fact and no person trivial enough to evade his curiosity. Richard left every classroom he entered at or near the top. Carter often just left the classroom. Carter poked fun at the way Richard walked around saying important-sounding things like, "All models are wrong. Some of them are useful." But he felt the alchemy in their interactions. "Richard has the part of my brain I don't have," he said. "Richard is a philosopher type," said Rajiv, who had brought them both into the White House. "He's good at putting things into a bigger context. Carter is good at putting things into a smaller context." Richard viewed models as a check on human judgment and as an aid to the human imagination. Carter viewed them more as flashlights. They allowed him to see what was inside a room that, until now, had been pitch black. Each day, the two doctors cooked up ideas and questions and sent them on to Bob Glass. In the beginning, the questions concerned this model he'd built with his teenage daughter. How much did the results change when you tinkered with the severity of the disease, or when you made different assumptions about how real-world Americans interacted, or when those Americans only partly complied with whatever you asked them to do? Once they were satisfied that this very simple model somehow captured a lot of truth about the social lives of Americans, and that it generated roughly the same answers even after you tinkered with the specifics. They bombarded it with their full curiosity. What happened when you closed just bars and restaurants, or just public transportation, or made people telework? What happened when you combined every possible strategy they could think of, in every possible combination? How many cases of the disease could you have in a community and still hope to contain it by closing schools and making kids spend 60% less time in one another's company? What else might this model reveal? A few days after Richard first called him, Bob Glass installed a bed on stilts beside his computer in a shed in the backyard. Each night in Albuquerque, he ran computer simulations of various pandemics and various responses to them, so these guys he'd never met could have answers when they arrived at work in the morning. He'd been promoted, basically overnight, from the world's most ignored pandemic modeler to the world's most important pandemic modeler. He didn't tell his daughter that he was moonlighting at the White House with her science fair project. "Kids get stressed," he said. He didn't ask his superiors at Sandia National Labs for permission, because he already knew the answer. "They kill people for doing that," he said. "They would flip and put people in between me and them, and I wouldn't be able to do anything." Everyone could see that kids played a role in disease transmission. No one imagined they would have the effect that they had in the glasses model. That didn't mean the model was right, but it might be. "It showed me where to dig," said Carter. I said, "I'm going to dig deeper, right here. Is there something about kids in schools that I don't know enough about and haven't thought about?" To Carter, digging meant gathering data, and no place on Earth collected as much of it as the United States government. In federal databases, he discovered that the majority of Americans employed by state and local government were employed in education, and he thought, no wonder those unions are so powerful. He learned that there were more than 100,000 K-12 schools in the country, with 50 million children in them. 25 million rode a bus to school. I thought, holy crap, half the kids in the U.S. hop on a school bus. There were 70,000 buses in the entire U.S. public transportation system, but 500,000 school buses. On an average day, school buses carried twice as many people as the entire U.S. public transportation system. A lot of the talk in the White House pandemic planning room had been about grown-ups, how they worked and traveled. "We'd been talking about the New York subway and the D.C. metro," said Carter. "But for every person hopping on public transportation in one day, there are two kids taking the school bus." How kids got to school was one issue. What happened once they were there was another. The Department of Education dug out blueprints of America's schools that enabled Carter to calculate just how much space each kid had. He did some math and reckoned that each elementary school child spent the day in a space with a radius of just 3.5 feet, which, when they reached high school, expanded to 4. "That can't be right," he thought. "It's too small." But then it had been a long time since he had been in school. "I called my wife," he recalled, "and told her, I want to go to school." Carter had married his high school sweetheart. Both he and Deborah had come from families with 6 children, and they had 6 children of their own. They'd remained in Atlanta during Carter's White House deployment. Carter commuted back and forth so that he was now home only on weekends. He'd, of course, attended parent-teacher conferences. He'd never been to one with the goal of studying the spacing of the children. Now he asked his wife to arrange a meeting with a teacher while school was in session. That whole day, from the moment they got in the car, he viewed the world through a new lens. "Look," he said, as they passed children waiting for the school bus. Look at the way kids stand at the bus stop. When adults stand at a bus stop, they give each other space. Kids are like those close talkers on Seinfeld. He and Deborah entered the school. Look, it's just a sea of humanity. I could almost walk across their heads. He watched the way they horsed around and jumped on each other's backs and behaved in ways that he no longer did. Look, they're so different. They're not little adults. They have a different sense of space. At length, they reached the classroom where the teacher waited. Carter had always disliked how they made you sit at one of the kids' desks during the parent-teacher conference. But now he didn't mind, as it allowed him to get a feel for how jammed together the students were during class. As the teacher spoke, he reached out his arms in either direction. Look, he said to himself. It's 3 feet. I can touch the person next to me. Leaving the school, he saw a bus and boarded it with a tape measure. The seats turned out to be 40 inches long. They estimate kids' hips are 13 inches across, so they can put them 3 to a seat, he said. The aisle was narrower than a normal bus. Paramedics knew not to bring a normal-sized stretcher onto a school bus, he later learned, because it wouldn't fit down the aisle. I couldn't design a system better for transmitting disease than our school system, he said after his visit. Until that moment, no one had really seen what was unusual about schools, at least from the point of view of the pandemic strategist. It had taken the glasses model to point it out. Why? Carter wondered. Why hadn't they seen it? Then it struck him. They saw it all with adult eyes. They forgot the world that their kids live in and that they once lived in. Adults imagined their spaces smaller than they were and children's spaces larger than they were. Experts who'd passed through the White House pandemic planning room sometimes brought up how dense the modern workplace was and the possible need in a pandemic to move to working from home. These are really smart people, said Carter. People who are national leaders in disease and epidemiology. Right away, they'd say, of course we need to do things in the workplace, telework. But even with all these damn cubicles, offices are nowhere near as dense as a classroom. After a while, he decided that the problem was the human mind. They'd forgotten childhood, he said. Adults just forget what it feels like to be a kid. To illustrate this point, he created a picture of a 2,600-square-foot home, but with the same population density as an American school, then turned it into a slide. The spacing of people, if homes were like schools, read the top. The inside of the typical American single-family home suddenly looked a lot like a refugee prison or the DMV on a bad day. There is nowhere anywhere as socially dense as school classrooms, school hallways, school buses, said Carter. The more Carter and Richard learned, the more excited they became. Imagine if we could affect the weather, Carter wrote in one of his long memos. Imagine if we had the capability to reduce a Category 5 storm to a Category 2 or 1. Now, although the federal government is not at the threshold of significantly reducing the potency of a hurricane, it is at the threshold of doing just this to another natural disaster, pandemic influenza. For his part, Richard began to deliver talks to small groups of important people about the way the model confirmed their hunch that there were things you could do to buy time before a vaccine. He'd coined a phrase for their strategy, Targeted Layered Containment, TLC. TLC's basic idea was the same as that underpinning Carter's approach to medical error. No single intervention would stop a flu-like disease in its tracks, just as no single safety measure would prevent a doctor from replacing the right hip when it was the left hip that hurt. The trick was to mix and match strategies in response to the nature of the disease and the behavior of the population. Each strategy was like another slice of Swiss cheese. Enough slices, properly aligned, would hide the holes. With any flu-like disease, the closure of K-12 schools was going to be one of the slices. But there were others. The thing that Bob's model let us do was to test our intuitions and see which of the tools we had could be successful, said Richard. Tell me if this works. Tell me when it breaks. Where their strategies failed was when a virus had a reproductive rate above 3. When each infected person infected more than 3 others, or when the society's rate of compliance fell below 30%. R-naught, or written R with a zero, is the shorthand for the idea. It's defined as how many people are infected, on average, by each infected person at the start of an epidemic, before any attempts have been made to intervene, either with drugs or social distancing. R-naught will change if people change their behaviors, say, or as people achieve immunity. There is a need for a second concept, effective R-naught. Effective R-naught is the term for the reproductive rate at any moment in time. To put an R-naught of 3 in context, the flu strain that caused the 1918 pandemic had an R-naught between 1.8 and 2.1. If you dial up the infectiousness to such an extent, you can overwhelm the interventions, said Richard. But Bob's model showed us that we had this huge margin of error. Carter was now digging furiously into the issue of school closure, and when Carter started digging, he usually stopped only after he'd reached China. This time, as he dug, a lot of people started hollering at him. When I started learning about schools, I was already hearing objections, said Carter. This is never going to work. Kids are going to start hanging out in shopping malls. Crime rates will skyrocket. Poor kids will starve. People won't be able to work with their kids at home. Here they were, inside the White House, doing exactly what the President of the United States had asked them to do, with money allocated to them by the U.S. Congress. But it turned out they still needed to persuade a lot of skeptical people in public health and education and emergency management and other corners of the U.S. government of their strategy's wisdom. The strategy would never work if it sat on some shelf in the White House. Lots of people had to believe in it, and lots of people already didn't. I'd give them things, said Bob Glass. They'd turn them into graphs and go give talks and get laughed out of the room. At some point, Richard and Carter realized that they'd need to change the minds of everyone working in and around public health, and that this meant first changing people's minds inside the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC sat at the top of the country's system of public health. In some ways, it sat at the top of the world's system of public health. Leaders everywhere looked to it for guidance. But there had been a reason Rajiv hadn't asked the CDC to join the team creating a new pandemic strategy. Whatever strategy the White House dreamed up would necessarily be original, he thought, and the people who already saw themselves as experts in the field would be least capable of original thought. They'd be constrained by their sense that they already knew everything worth knowing about disease control, and would be threatened by the possibility that, in fact, they did not. And that might have been true, but it created a tension between these two doctors who were making it up as they went along and the people who regarded themselves as the world's authorities on disease control. As they finished the plan, Carter got the first whiff of the CDC's condescension. There had been one final chapter to write, on how to keep big institutions, public and private, running during a pandemic. Somehow, everyone on the team had agreed that it needed to be written into the plan without anyone's agreeing to write it. One day, Rajiv stopped by and asked Carter about what everyone now just referred to as Chapter 9. "There's nothing in Chapter 9, Carter said. "You write it," said Rajiv. "I don't know shit about it," said Carter. "Write it anyway," said Rajiv. "No one else knows anything either." Carter thought, "This is the boring crap. That's why I'm getting stuck with it." He wrote it up anyway. He ran what he wrote through a software program he'd created that spotted any inconsistencies with the U.S. government's grotesque style manual, then sent it on to the relevant agencies for comment. It came back, fast. Every sentence marked up in red and disputed. "The only thing that hadn't been crossed out was the title," said Carter. He paged through the comments and saw that most came from just one person inside the CDC. Her comments were not warm and encouraging. Carter handed them to Richard, and Richard went off and phoned her, then came back and said, "She wouldn't even talk to me." "Usually when you said you were so-and-so calling from the White House, the person on the other end of the line treated you with at least a smattering of respect." "Who is this bitch?" said Richard. "I don't know," said Carter, "but I'm going to find out." The following week, instead of flying back to Washington, Carter visited one of the campuses occupied by the Centers for Disease Control. He'd lived in Atlanta for nearly a decade, but he'd never been inside the place or met anyone who worked there. On the way, he'd calmed down a bit and reread the CDC woman's comments. Maybe 20 people from around the federal government had offered criticisms of what he'd written, and hers were the only ones that suggested actual knowledge of the subject. All the comments from other people were stupid things like changing happy to glad, he said. "Everything she said makes sense." He was surprised by just how far down in the CDC she was. When he called, they passed him to her rung by rung down this long ladder. But she still had a name, Lisa Coonan. Lisa Coonan had grown up in Atlanta in the 1960s. When she was 14, a doctor removed her appendix, and she decided there and then that she wanted to be able to do that kind of thing for others. She confessed her ambition to a school guidance counselor. The counselor told her that if she wanted to have a family, she couldn't be a doctor, but might become a nurse. She became a nurse. After nursing school, she'd run a pediatric nursing unit at Douglas General Hospital and pursued a master's in public health. Her thesis established that mistakes by anesthesiologists were killing women during childbirth. It was wholly original, and it led the CDC to offer her a job in a unit that studied maternal mortality. Over the next two decades, she had moved around some inside the CDC, but she never rose as high as she might have had she been a doctor. She remained just one of 12,000 foot soldiers there. She loved the place and admired its people, but she was shadowed by a life she hadn't lived. By the time Carter came to see Lisa, she was running an unfashionable unit inside something called the Division of Partnerships and Strategic Alliances. She worked with big companies to get them to nudge their employees to better health by, say, paying for their flu shots and their Nicorette gum. She'd been recently assigned to create a checklist of things companies should do to prepare for a pandemic. She couldn't make anybody do anything, but the prestige of the CDC was such that, by and large, people welcomed her phone calls. The checklist gave her a view of the challenges companies might face if a serious disease ever swept the country. After she'd finished it, she got a call from her boss asking her if she'd review a paper related to her checklist that had just come in from the White House. "Already there is something odd here," she said. "Usually CDC is creating the strategy." She saw that the White House document had been passed down, rung by rung, inside the CDC by people who didn't want to deal with it, until it had finally, and a bit surprisingly, reached her. "I was a nobody," she said. "I had no position or stature." She opened it and marked everything she found wrong, which was basically everything, and sent it back to her boss. "I was kind of a typical CDC person. Everything was no, no, no. Everything had to be right, and it had to be so right that it was not wrong." When one of the document's authors rang her up directly, she suspected it was some kind of prank. He says, "This is Richard Hatchett from the White House." I was, "Yeah, right. I guess my self-image was no one from the White House is going to call me." So sure she was that she was inefficiently important to receive this kind of attention that she'd hung up on the guy. "I was not friendly," she said. Now the White House was visiting, in the person of Carter Mesher, so Lisa Coonan couldn't really deny that the White House wanted to speak with her. Yet she was prepared to remain unfriendly. She had an unflattering preconception of guy from the White House, blue suit, self-important, stuck up. 3 hours later, she'd more or less agreed to write Chapter 9 for Carter Mesher. "I just liked him instantly," she recalled.